All right, welcome to the next episode of our How I Built It podcast. It is a pleasure today. This is Adriana Masters from New Practitioners Committee to welcome another New Practitioner Committee member, Woody McClellan, who is going to tell us a little bit about how he built a clinical trial and what that has entailed. But thank you, Woody, for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's truly an honor to be here.
Fantastic. So in general, kind of what sparked your interest in research?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think a lot of people, you know, they do something maybe in high school or, you know, maybe in college. And I really didn't have, you know, I didn't have like a whole lot of, you know, much of anything really. And then I think, you know, as many people know, I was in neurosurgery before I came to radiation oncology. And so that's where a lot of like my research interests started. And I firmly believe that, you know, every paper, every, you know, manuscript has a story behind it. And it, you know, I think it's something you should believe in. Like you should believe that you are publishing something to make a difference. And, you know, I'm, you know, the first paper I ever published was like shortly after I graduated med school. So, you know, for all out there who, you know, think, oh my gosh, I'm starting med school, I don't have any papers. Like, don't worry, I didn't have any either.
That kind of surprises me actually.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I, you know, actually just had a paper accepted today. So I'm at one, I'm at 170, I'm at 175 now. So,
oh my gosh.
I'm living proof that like you don't have to start like super early to be productive. But I would say from a research standpoint, the opportunity to make a difference, the opportunity, what I've learned is kind of looking at things like, hey, that hasn't been done. We should, you know, we should address this. And not being afraid to say, well, who am I to address this? It's like, well, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like the saying, half baked's better than raw. So like, even if you're not an expert on it, the fact that you're looking into it, and I've seen this, I've had this happen several times where I'll look into something and someone will say, well, this can be done better. I'm like, yes, please show me, you know.
Let's do it. Okay.
Right. So, I would say those things really sparked my interest and still spark my interest now. I mean, I do like publishing. I like having a lot of publications, but the biggest thing is like every one of the papers I published, I can feel proud of because there was a particular story that was involved.
That's really neat. You know, I think it's sometimes a matter of saying, wow, I would really like to know the answer to this question.
Yep.
Has anybody already figured out, you know, what this is or how this works or, you know, even some the foundational concepts of, you know, how a mechanism happens. And even if, you know, somebody hasn't even scratched the surface, that's a perfect opportunity.
Exactly.
I like your perspective on that. That's great. Because it is like one of those traps you can fall into of like, well, who am I to answer this question? Or who am I to like start this project? Or, but why not you is a great way to think about it.
Exactly.
Because
you know, I think in medicine, it's so hierarchical.
Yes.
You know, we're taught to think less of ourselves for so long. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the switch is flipped and it's like, you're supposed to be the expert on everything. I just think that it's much more of a gradual process. And, you know, it's curiosity is important and really thinking about, okay, how is this actually going to help people is important. And I think, you know, that is a big reason why I started this trial actually. I think, you know, I think as you delve into more and more important questions that can affect multiple people, a lot of people, you know, those are the kind of things that need the highest level evidence for. And if that highest level evidence isn't out there, then oftentimes like, you know, it's up to you to generate it.
To make it. Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about, what was your research question?
So, as people may or may not know, I'm the director of spine oncology at Case Western Medical Center. I have appointments in radiation oncology and neurosurgery. Yeah. And one of the things that I'm very interested in is spine radiosurgery, also known as spine stereotactic body radiation therapy. Essentially, what is the best way to deliver spine radiosurgery? Because in the United States, most people deliver spine SBRT in 3 fractions, some deliver it in 5 fractions. And there are, the idea of doing it single fraction really has become a little bit outdated right now. And so I thought, we'll talk about this, but there was a trial out of Canada by Segal et al., which was really kind of the first level one evidence trial to compare compare spine SBRT with conventional external beam and actually show a benefit of SBRT. In that trial, they used 24 grain 2 fractions for their BRT. And, because of that really provided level one evidence, that's the fractionation that I use. Again, it's different than like 90% of people in the US who do spine. A lot of people, they'll do 27 and 3, they'll do 30 and 3, et cetera, et cetera. But my thoughts, and this probably goes back to my time in neurosurgery, because the idea of radiosurgery initially was to essentially be equivalent of surgery, right? You provide similar outcomes, you're killing the tumor, you're not physically taking it out like surgery, but you also don't have complications that come with surgery.
Yes.
And you're doing it in one day. That was the idea. And so I thought, is there a way that we can do that in one day for spine radiosurgery and have good outcomes, or at least comparable to the standard of care? And so that's what led me to create this trial. One thing I'm learning about trials is that it's always good to have it to proactively come up with a name for your trial, because if you don't, then whatever IRB you put it through, they'll create a name and that name will stick. And it's just, it's pretty annoying. So
you want like a fun acronym or like something that can be
exactly
attributable. And,
and you also want, and ideally you want an acronym that kind of spells out what your trial does.
Yes.
So those are the best ones, right? So like, I think in breast cancer, right, the AMOROS trial is an example of an acronym that's like that, right? Because it's like, I think it's like, after mapping, right? After mapping of the axilla, right? It's like radiation or surgery, right? It's perfect. It tells
or like you what EMBRACE is like the adaptive planning for cervical cancer, and then it gets like cervix in there and
Exactly. So, for that reason, I was like, okay, well, what do I want to do? The purpose of this trial is to see what is the optimal radiosurgery, treatment of these patients. And so, eventually I came up with the name spine patient optimal radiosurgery treatment for symptomatic metastatic neoplasm. And that makes up sportsmen, and so, so this is the sportsman trial. And its goal is to do exactly that. And so one thing about trials, and I have to say, I was very fortunate because where I trained in radiation oncology at Indiana was probably one of the only places, I think it was the only place actually, where you had the opportunity as a PGY2 to develop a trial, like essentially from its inception. And the idea was that, you had 2-3 years. So that by the time you were PGY5, you'd have data on a mature trial that you could present at like ASTRO or ASCO or something like that.
And how cool is that? What a great opportunity.
And, the trial I created there was actually looking at, reducing stereotactic radiosurgery dose for brain mets in people who had concomitant immunotherapy. So, so that trial was, radiosurgery dose reduction, for brain mets on immunotherapy. We called that RAD-REMI, right? So, I think I was very fortunate to be in that environment. My principal, the person who was my mentor on that, Gordon Watson, rest in peace. He was, phenomenal. And I learned a lot of things in developing that trial, enrolling patients on that trial that have really helped me currently on the Sportsman trial as well.
Yeah, so please elaborate.
So I think one thing is, you know, you have to be the biggest advocate for your trial, no matter how excited other people may be about it, and other people who are much smarter than you, much more talented than you, and much more accomplished in radiation oncology than you. Ultimately, they're not going to have the same fervor for your trial that you will have.
Yes.
And, you know, in, you know, for example, for RadRemi, I had to fight literally from the beginning because there were people that were trying to talk me out of it. There were people. There's like, oh, well, you know, couldn't you do a trial on another disease site? Or couldn't, and I said, no, I want to do this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to have a kind of clear vision about that. Another thing I learned is a trial is essentially useless if it doesn't have data, right? Mm-hmm. And so you want to try to create a trial that is easy to enroll on, that has a clear question, and that is as simple as possible. You know, we in radiation oncologists, you know, tend to be really, really smart people. And, you know, smart people tend to try to make simple things complicated.
And that is very true.
And that is exactly the opposite of what you want to do on a trial. Like when you're creating a trial, you want the trial to be as simple as possible, almost way too simple, because I guarantee you, no matter how simple you design your trial, things will come up that make it more complicated.
That's very good advice.
Start by trying to make it as simple as possible. There's a chance that it will actually work. Because you know, I saw this, you know, because I saw this at you know, where I trained, where, like, you know, people would come up with these concepts and they were like, wow, this is cool. But then you look at it, wow, how are they ever gonna accrue? Right.
Yeah,
and
like, so how many people do you need to answer that question, as complicated as it is, you know?
Right. The other thing I learned is that it really is a team sport, and the team isn't just, you know, your department, and it isn't just other physicians. It's the research team. It's the research staff, the nurse coordinators, and kind of letting everyone know about the trial and, you know, hey, we have this trial, you know, this is why we're doing it. This is what we want to enroll on, you know, enroll based on, would you be willing to, you know, to help, you know, propagate it, et cetera? You know, that goes a long way. And I think the other thing is, you know, just be prepared for frustration. You know, it's going to happen, especially with the IRB. It's just about anticipating, you know, things and, you know, being willing to change. And, you know, I'm a big fan of kind of superhero kind of, you know, stuff. And there's a show called The Flash where one of the villains talks about, you know, four keys, right? You know, make a plan, execute the plan, expect the plan to go off the rails, throw away the plan, right? and a lot of that, there's a lot of truth to that when it comes to trials, because you know, you may have this, you may have this plan you think is great, and you're all of a sudden like, oh, wow, like, I don't think I'll be able to enroll in this. Or, you know, the IRB may just say, we will not let you do it this way. And you could say, but there's no evidence for what you're saying. And they're like, we don't care. We're just not doing it.
This is still the answer that we have. Yeah.
Right. And you really just have to be able to adjust. And, you know, you can document, yes, we've lost X number of patients because of this IRB's decision, but ultimately, like, it's still on you to you know to get it done,
to kind of find a way. And I think too, like, at the end of that four piece, you know, make a plan, execute, expect this plan to go off the rails, and then throw it away, I think then you got to rinse and repeat and do it again. And just however many iterations it takes you to get there, I think was the most surprising part to me about my first trial, was like, how many different times are we going to go through this same refining the idea process? My gosh.
Exactly. And and then, you know, I would say, you know, be prepared for criticism of your trial. Just be prepared for, people, you know, saying, oh, we don't need this, or, you know, et cetera. Why are you, you know, and just being, you know, steadfast about it, you know, and, you know, what I talked about earlier, as far as like having the energy to do, you know, your trial. So when I was during residency, a lot of the times I spent, you know, working on my trial was not my research time. Like I was actually on clinic. And so I'd be like, for example, on a GYN rotation, and I get a call about, you know, hey, this patient's interested, but like, he doesn't, he's not sure. And I'm like, oh, wow, if I don't talk to this patient, they're not going to enroll. And so I literally would have to like, take time away from prepping for like a breaky case or something like that to call this patient and make sure. And, you know, that comes, you know, you're only going to do that if you really believe in what you're doing. And if you really believe, and if you believe this has a chance to succeed. And so that gets back to trying to make a trial as simple as possible.
Yeah, that's awesome advice. You know, what kind of things during that refinement process surprised you or were unexpected?
Well, I just mentioned one, the IRB, because, you know, I can kind of fathom when like IRB has criticisms based on evidence, but it's which is purely like, oh, we don't like this. Like that's really tough because, you know, they are the gatekeeper. And, you know, and I think the other thing is I think people overestimate, you know, the ability to get things done in a fast manner. And so like, oh yeah, we'll do this. And like, if you really just double what they say, oftentimes it's going to be, you know, the time frame of when things are really going to happen.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I would say for myself, you know, for this trial, I've been very fortunate. I'm very fortunate to be in University Hospitals in Cleveland because, you know, our research team is great. You know, our protocol review monitoring committee is great. You know, the IRB is actually pretty reasonable. You know, I was able, you know, I wrote most of this trial, you know, in July of last year, and we were able to get IRB approval like literally 2 days before Christmas, and we opened the trial, you know, mid-January. So, and there's just not many places, you know, in the U.S. where we're talking about, you know.
That's pretty amazing. Like in less than 1 year, you went from like trial design to having it open.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and it's really... And again, I think a lot of that goes back to being simple, like making this as simple as possible. You know, this trial, what we're trying to do is we're trying to compare the standard of care with spinal radiosurgery, which is 24 grain, two fractions, because that is the only regimen that has been proven by level one evidence. And again, I had a desire to look at, you know, one single fraction. So I decided on 19 gray. And the reason I chose 19 gray was because there have been several studies that have shown that, you know, fraction sizes 20 gray and higher have a, you know, high, you know, vertebral compression fracture risk. You know, for example, the 24 gray and one fraction regimen, which is championed by Memorial Sloan Kettering, you know, as like having a really high tumor control rate. Well, 24 and one would. But it also, has a 40% of vertebral compression fracture risk, 40 or zero.
That's huge, right?
It is.
Versus like, what would be your estimate for the current regimen, the 19 and one?
So, and you know, the typical risk of vertebral compression fracture is about 15%. And I would suspect that the 19 and one would be very similar to that. Won't know until we actually do the trial, but that was the design, the thinking about that. And so when you, the other, so that was the kind of why not higher than 19. Then the other question is, well, why not lower than 19, right? Because 19 is just this random number, right? Like where did this come from? And so the other main randomized trial that has compared spine SBRT to conventional external beam, with the RTOG 0631. And you can tell immediately by that name, designed in 2006, right? So for a long time, it was kind of the standard bearer. It's like, oh, this trial is going to be the one that kind of defines SBRT. And they used single fraction, either 16 gray or 18 gray. And I believe 55% of their patients got 16 gray and 45% got 18 gray. And what they found was that either 16 gray or 18 gray times one, both at 3 and 6 months, did not provide superior pain freedom compared to simply acre times one palliative external beam APPA.
There
are many questions about that trial, the choice of an endpoint and things like that.
Yes.
But right now we essentially have two randomized, controlled trials that have conflicting outcomes. And so I'll get into this later because this gets into like what I changed about the trial. But I chose 19 gray because I felt that, it was higher than what failed in 0631, but low mm-hmm. enough to be safer than the doses we know cause a vertebral compression fracture risk. And so the initial idea of the trial was essentially to compare, 19 gray, in one to 24 gray in two. Mm-hmm. And then, I want to get to another aspect that's important about trials is having a really good team and really being willing to humble yourself when you have an idea and you're thinking about something and somebody who is along, it's like, hey, why don't we try this, etc. And for me in this trial, that person is my chairman, Dan Spratt.
Yeah.
He is, he's obviously well known in prostate, as everyone knows, but he's also, well known in spine as well. And I was very, very honored that he, recruited me to come here to University Hospitals. And so, when I was designing this trial, he was like, well, we still don't know a whole lot about eight gray times one, compared to this, what if we added that as a third arm? And I thought about it, and initially I was like, it might make it harder to enroll. But the more I thought about it, I was like, oh, this makes sense. And so I added that largely because of his input. And so it's a three-arm trial. So it's 24 gray in two, 19-1 SBRT, and then the other arm is conventional external beam eight gray times one. And so, what I didn't know at the time I created this, because I never thought, 0631 would actually be published. When they presented their data at ASTRO 2019, it kind of like
that presentation. It was kind of like, deflating,
Exactly. I was just about to say that. It was so deflating. Because it was like, oh my gosh. But Seagal, actually, he was one of the commentators of that trial at that ASTRO meeting. And he said, he was basically, he was like, well, the results of this trial are disappointing, but, my trial is actually up and we should have results in a year. And so I think it was next year ASTRO, which of course was completely virtual because of COVID, but he presented that trial, the one I talked about, the 24 gray and two fractions. They compared it to 20 gray and five external beam, but that was the trial that gave people hope again that, we can do SBRT and
And it can make a difference.
Right. Exactly. And so, so really it was kind of, experience seeing kind of, 0631, and also seeing Seagal's trial that I was like, wow, it would be nice to actually have a trial in the US that looked at it, that looked at eight gray times one and found spine SBRT to be better. Because Seagal's trial essentially involved all these countries, but none were the US. And again, like 0631 had, I think, about 100 more patients than Seagal's trial did. So essentially, what I didn't envision at the time, but is the case now, is that my trial is essentially the tiebreaker, because, we have one that says there's no difference between eight gray times one and SBRT. Mm-hmm. We have one that says SBRT is better with regard to pain control. There are other benefits of SBRT, local control, durability response,
et
cetera. But essentially Sportsman is the tiebreaker, of that. And so, we've enrolled about seven patients so far. I'm hoping to expand to other sites. Our goal is to enroll 240 patients over 4 years. And the idea behind the trial basically is that after our first 120 patients, we'll do an analysis of SBRT arms versus the external beam arm. Mm-hmm. If the SBRT arms are superior, as we expect, then the external beam arm will drop out and the remainder of the trial will just be comparing 24 gray and 2 to 19 gray times one. I am optimistic that we will be able to get the 120 patients in about a 2 year span.
Okay. And then how did you pick when to time that interim analysis?
So that gets to another thing about a trial. I think you're almost dead in the water if you do not have a biostatistician
that you are absolutely from
the jump.
And so, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and so at UH, Yilin Sun, he is our biostatistician. He's the main biostatistician on this trial. He also happens to be in my lab, which is great.
Fantastic.
Literally from the beginning, once I decided this is what I want, et cetera, like I asked, hey, how realistic is this, sample size wise, et cetera, working with him and working with Dr. Spratt, it was really the three of us that kind of came through with kind of most of this. And so the interim analysis was his suggestion as far as the number of patients. And it does make sense, from that standpoint, but yeah, that's the other thing too. If you are going to design a trial, as early as possible, see if you can get someone from biostats to be on board. Because if you do not have someone with biostats to be on board, there are many, many people who will just automatically write your trial off saying, oh, you're not serious, you don't have biostats on. And those people are probably right, because there's so many things that we don't think of that they do, because again, that's why they have PhDs in stats
Absolutely. Like I think I like very much like as an early resident really underestimated the difference between, I could learn how to do some simple programming in R or use a software, but when it comes to trial design, the vast importance of understanding the meaning behind all of those variables and thinking about what kind of additional ones you need to input and how they'll affect your sample size and outcomes. And I really underestimated that personally.
I think most of us doctors do, right? Because we don't do it all the time. And I think, I have sensed from the biostats community a kind of like rolling of their eyes when doctors talk about certain things, because they're like, oh yeah, they haven't considered this or that, and they think they can just do everything on their own. So again, I think humility is a very important component of it's the humility to involve other people. It's the humility to say, hey, I don't have all the answers. Let's work with other people. But it's also a confidence, right? So you have to have humility for that, but you also have the confidence to stand up for yourself when other people say, hey, this trial shouldn't be done, or I don't believe in this, et cetera. So it's a mix.
That's a balance there, right? Like being able to accept some feedback, to adapt, you need to adapt, but to really have that passion, that fire to continue on the path to answering that question.
Yep. Yeah.
It's very neat.
And so I think that, from that standpoint, with our three arms, essentially, I've had patients ask me, it's like, the question that I think all doctors should welcome from patients, many don't, but it's like, hey, if this was your family member, what would you do? Would you want them on this trial, et cetera, et cetera? Dr. Vinay Prasad, actually, medical oncologist, a lot of his criticisms of many randomized trials in the med-onc community are how bad their control arms are, right? And so it's like, if you have this new drug, but you're comparing it to this control arm that's like not standard of care, like, of course the new drug's gonna be better. But would you enroll your family member on that trial? Given the fact that they could get a substandard control arm? And so that's for me, it was very important. Right, exactly. So it's very important to have the two arms that are not experimental have, level one evidence supports them, right? So 8 grain times one is supported by RTOG 0631, right? 24 grains supported by SC24, which is the Segal et al. Trial. For those who aren't intimately acquainted with the spine literature, the Segal et al. Trial published in Lancet Oncology in 2021. And RTOG 0631 was just published in JAMA Oncology literally 2 weeks ago, I think, or 3 weeks ago. I think it was April 20th. If you're interested, those are two really good references to use. And the Segal trial for me was one that I used One, obviously, for the dose, because, as from a practice standpoint, it completely, it was like, yes, I'm going to do 24 and two. I don't care that everyone else does 27 and three. And I don't care if physics and dosimetry get mad at me. It's like, why are you doing two fractions? Don't we have to do all these new dose constraints? I'm like, yes, but
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's right. Usually my answer.
Right, exactly. So
thank you. I appreciate your efforts. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Because again, it's about humility, right? It's about team. And we have great physicists at UH. The two that are the main ones on the trial are Rajano Kashani and Valdir Kalusi. Mm-hmm. And it's really been a great environment, because again, like just like with stats, right? Physicists know things that doctors don't.
And so many things.
and it's really about kind of like being willing to kind of, humble yourself and learn from them. And at the same time, they're learning from you too, right? Because they're seeing, okay, what does the doctor actually think is important, right? For us, it's like, oh, what does physics actually think is safe and achievable? So it really is a really kind of a good mix. But the Segal trial was the reason I chose 24 in two, and it also was the reason I chose the primary endpoint I did, because the primary endpoint of sportsmen is pain freedom at 3 months using the brief pain inventory. Because that's the primary endpoint that the Segal trial used.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to kind of compare apples to apples.
Yes.
And, secondary endpoints are at 6 months. But the primary endpoint I wanted to be one, it's short enough where, for example, you have, again, these patients by definition have symptomatic metastatic spine disease, right? So,
yes.
There are a lot of trials where it's like, okay, we're going to get 1 year follow-up, right? Or we're, but in this one, literally, they just need, essentially MedOncs to say, is their prognosis greater than 3 months? Yes. So again, this is about trying to make it as simple as possible.
A simple, achievable, accruable trial.
Exactly. And, and I think, I forget. Saber Comet, the lead author of Saber Comet. He talked about kind of like thinking about that as far as like making that a primary thing when you're designing trials, like is this achievable? And I think that's something I'd always thought about, but when I actually heard him say it, I was like, oh yes, this is even more so like the way I'm really glad I think about it this way, because again, most trials fail. Like the vast majority of trials fail. The vast majority of trials fail to accrue. And even the ones that do accrue, like, it's like, okay, did this really answer anything that's helpful to people?
I think like from my perspective, from someone that is presenting a trial, like having a trial that you believe that all of the arms could be the potential best option is so much more meaningful. And so such an easier conversation to have with that patient, with that family, to say, yes, I think all of these options are reasonable. And I think that, you're benefiting your patient more if you have them accruing to a trial that you think is going to be successful and to answer a question and is achievable.
Agreed. And, one of the things I tell patients is, cause they ask me, okay, if this was your family member, what would, which one would you choose? And I told them, I said, well, I think that SBRT is better. But we all thought that, before 0631 came out.
Yeah, right? Definitely. We expected to get a very different answer at first.
Right, exactly. So I tell them, I think SBRT is better. And so if we didn't have this trial open, I would recommend SBRT. But the reason I created this trial is that I wanted to answer this question. And so what I would say is, I would recommend this trial to answer that question. But if you are not interested in being on the trial, then I would recommend SBRT. And so that way I'm being as honest as I can, as transparent as I can with patients, and also kind of, helping them understand like, hey, this is why this trial was created and is happening.
Yeah. And that's why we've asked you to participate, because, we don't 100% know the answer. We think that we have, good reasoning behind testing the different options. But if mm-hmm. we already knew the answer, then we wouldn't be going through the trial.
Exactly. And again, I think that's, you know, radiation, you know, has the opportunity to have these trials with these shorter endpoints compared to chemo, you know, and I think that is something that, you know, we can take advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. In the right context, you know, it's not the same as, you know, looking for an overall survival benefit in intermediate risk prostate cancer. Like there's such a wide range of different points in a patient's, you know, cancer journey that we can be beneficial to them. And that's one of the things I really like about it.
I agree.
There are many opportunities.
Yeah. And, you know, but again, like a lot of the trials aren't doing overall survival anymore, right? I mean, even these, these newly expensive drugs, right? They're saying, oh, this gives a, like, you know, disease-free survival of this. And it's like, well, your new drug costs like, you know, $600,000 a year compared to like the standard, you know, is it worth it to pay that much for, you know, a disease-free survival benefit?
Or progression-free survival at 3 months, you know, it's going to cost you several tens of thousands of dollars.
Exactly. When, you know, oftentimes, you know, radiation can give the progression-free survival benefit and cost much, much less. So,
yeah, definitely. I think like having that 8 gray times 1 arm too is really helpful in that way too, because that's part of like the Choosing Wisely campaign. You know, thinking about doing, does everyone necessarily need spine SBRT? I mean, I think it's a question that we would all love to know the answer to. And I'm excited to have that as an arm because I like the background of knowing kind of how that process happened, because too, I would think, you know, you're a spine radiosurgery expert. You like doing spine radiosurgery. You're invested in it. It's an excellent process and it's a useful tool. But how do we pick which patients may need that tool and which ones may not benefit as much?
Exactly. And also, I mean, to be, you know, to be as candid as possible, adding the 8 gray times 1 arm does hamstring the trial a bit, because there are many people who are just automatically going to be like, oh, you know, I like your trial, but I just couldn't put myself to give a patient a 33% chance of getting 8 gray times 1. I just couldn't do it. And that's
really,
and that's a very fair. Yeah. And there's some patients where I think that's very fair. I mean, for example, you know, I had a patient about 2 months ago, you know, I was just thinking, oh yeah, I want to, you know, enroll, but you know, this person had like, you know, just, you know, a large, you know, paraspinal mass. He had like Bilski 3, well, it was Bilski 2 at first, but then became Bilski 3, cord compression. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, this person needs SBRT, And if I enroll this person on this trial, I'm giving them a 33% chance of getting 8 gray times 1, which I personally do not believe will help this guy, right?
And so be as durable a response and will be as beneficial even in a limited time frame.
Right, exactly. And so, and again, that's where it's like, would you do this to someone you care about? Right? Would you do this to someone you love? And so I'm very cognizant of the fact that the people I'm enrolling on this trial are people I honestly believe that like any one of the three options, one, you know, is appropriate, and two, I would do one that I love.
Yeah. So then like when you're designing your trial and you're picking the inclusion and the exclusion criteria, do you leave it fairly broad or do you kind of pick out some of those finer details or
how do you balance? Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think, again, about trying to make it as simple to accrue as possible.
Yeah.
I think you don't want to have too many exclusion criteria, but at the same time, you want to have it tight enough where you feel like you're going to be able to answer the question you're trying to answer. So like if you look at kind of the inclusion criteria that we have, it's fairly simple, right? I mean, one of the things, you know, basically the main contraindication is patients cannot have had radiation to the spinal level that's being treated. You know, at all. And so that, you know, it makes sense, right? You know, but it has unintended consequences, right? Like, so for example, if you have a patient that has, you know, disease at, you know, I don't know, T3, T2 or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
you know, and but let's say they had metastatic breast cancer, right? And 5 years ago, they had a mastectomy and then had, comprehensive post-mastectomy RT, right? With regional nodal radiation. Like part of that T3, T2 probably is in the field, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're not going to be eligible for the trial solely because of that. So things like that, you know, it's like, oh, that sucks. But you know, this is why, again, if you design it simple, then you don't have to worry about complicated things happening.
Yeah. So then you're not having to think through like, well, like what should the minimum or maximum dose be to that level? Or, you know, how do we interpret this person's outcome? Is it because of, you know, the arm they were randomized to? Or is it because they had previous radiation nearby?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think it's really just about trying to, again, make it simple as possible, make, you know, exclusion criteria simple, because I think that also helps with the IRB as well, because I think, you know, again, the IRB's job is to protect patients, right? Mm-hmm. Their job is to prevent, you know, doctors from just doing things that seem right to us, and again, like there are many abuses in research, you know, 50, 60 years ago that made the creation of IRBs, you know, necessary. And, you know, I like to think that I have, you know, a strong enough moral compass that if I was just given the ability to do whatever I wanted on trials, that I would do the right thing. But I do think IRBs are important, you know, with that. And so, you know, they're frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. they are. But too, like, it also allows, I think, the society to know that there is some regulation, that there's some give and take. Yes. And even people that were, you know, going to do the right thing anyway, have gone through this process and have, you know, had the transparency to say, yes, we're going to do the right thing. We've had members of the community and different parts of the organization and all kinds of different folks to review it and think that this is a reasonable thing to do.
Exactly. And again, like there's some things that, you know, the IRB is just going to say, we don't believe in this and there's nothing you can do about it. Exactly. But the clearer your aims are, the simpler things are, you know, the easier it is for the IRB to kind of see, oh, this can get done. And then their question isn't about, can this get done? Their only question is this safe? Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's an expression I've heard on actually a fantasy football podcast a few years ago that talks about borrowing brilliance, right? And it's basically like, you know, looking at what's been done and essentially borrowing the brilliance of, you know, things that have gone before you. And sportsmen, is a lot of borrowing brilliance. I mean, the Seagal trial really, you know, changed the standard of care and in my mind has saved spine radiosurgery. Because if it was just 0631 data, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it would be very, very difficult to justify it to an insurance company, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But because of the Seagal, the data that, you know, the trial was so well done and everything, like, you know, we can do spine SBRT to these patients who, you know, desperately need not only like pain relief, but durable control and
absolutely,
et cetera. A lot of the brilliance of their trial, I think, was they had a simple design too, as far as like the 3 months, as far as brief pain inventory, and so I, you know, we borrowed, that from them to answer our question as well, and so and things like that help, I think, with an IRB, because an IRB says, oh wow, okay, this has been done before, like we've seen this done, they're doing it in a new way, and
this
so
is not like just out of left field that they've just, you know, decided to do something entirely unfounded. It's just they've adapted to answer parts of questions that have been answered, adapted to a new setting or in a slightly different way.
Exactly.
Yeah, much easier argument to make.
Yeah. So even though it's an argument that may not be the one you ultimately want to make, right? You may have much bigger ideas and much grander schemes than that. But I think, again, part of it is the humility, again, to know that, okay, we're not going to be able to answer all those right now. So let's answer the things we can answer feasibly, and then we'll have a lot, you know, stronger leg to stand on when we want to try to get into those higher heights.
So there's like the short term and then the long term goal.
Yes.
Right. Like This is the question we can answer now. But then when you designed this trial, were you also thinking about, like, depending on what the outcome is, what is the next step? Like, what other things do you want to answer?
Well, I mean, there's several different aspects of this trial that think are interesting. One, and I was, again, I've been interested in spine radiosurgery for a long time. When I was a nerve surgery resident, and then when I transitioned to radiation oncology, I spent a year as a spine research fellow at NYU Orthopedics. Essentially, one of the, that kind of inspired me to, lead, really was the first study looking at spine SBRT in the US, just like overall, how people practice, who gets access to it. And what we found was that people who are on Medicaid, were, 30% less likely to get spine SBRT versus conventional. And patients who are Black were 20% less likely. And so one of the aspects of a sportsman that I'm very proud of is that one of our aims is actually looking at, demographics by race, by gender, as far as who gets access to an SBRT versus conventional. I do want to give a shout out to, the Robert Wynn Diversity in Clinical Trials Award, because they are, they're the principal funder of this trial. And one of the reasons I believe that they funded this is because of their belief in, my track record as far as spine and also in diversity, equity.
Yes, absolutely.
And the fact that, not only are we, would 19-1 versus 24-2 versus 8-1 be very, very interesting and very, very important, which it will be, but also who gets access to these therapies. And so that's, I'm actually very proud that that's one of the arms of our trial. And because again, like a lot of the trials, even ones in radiation oncology that we swear by, like if you look closer, like, are they really that diverse, right?
So no, like, they're really not.
Like, I mean, the PROTECT trial, right? Like, yes. I think they just published their 15-year results, right? In the journal.
Yeah.
And like, people swear this is the GOAT trial, and et cetera. And like, if you look, 97% of the patients on that trial were white. 97%. 1% were Black, and literally everybody else was called other, right? And if you look at that trial, the number of patients on that trial who actually had high risk prostate cancer was greater than the number of Black patients on that trial. So
infuriating that is the case.
Right. But, but nobody's saying we should do active surveillance for high risk prostate cancer. Right. So why are we saying that those results are applicable to everyone, regardless of race or gender? Right. So, I think that's an example of an extremely well done trial that has limitations of lack of diversity. And so I am proud of Sportsman that, already, again, where our clinic is located is 46% Black. The patients we've already enrolled, we have a fairly good number of underrepresented minorities. And again, my goal is to essentially have that representation, match what is in the U.S. Census.
That's amazing.
Because if we're to do that, U.S. it's about 12-13% Black in the U.S. Census. And if you look at most trials in oncology and including radiation oncology, you're lucky to get 5%, lucky to get 6%, right? And so, and I think that's another important aspect of Sportsman as well, is that, yes, we are answering this, question about like dose. We're also addressing access to these therapies. And I think, for those who are critics of diversity, equity, inclusion, I've heard some people say it's not real science, et cetera. ultimately, it's about, can patients get the treatment that you're offering? Because if they can't, then ultimately it's not going to help them. And it's ultimately, not going to do humanity much good. That is an aspect of Sportsman I'm very proud of, is that we are looking into that. And, when we have data, I'm pretty confident we will be by far the most diverse spine radiosurgery trial that has been created.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And then too, that those results are applicable to the population that could get them. You know, it's not, well, it's probably around the same.
Right,
and
exactly.
You really honestly don't know.
Right, exactly.
Everyone is a 70-kilogram male medical student in perfect health, and that's our population that we've used for this trial.
You know, right, right. Like,
exactly. Much of medicine.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. What tips do you have for accruing a diverse patient population or for trials?
Well, that's an excellent question, because that, to be honest, that is still an that's still something I am trying to answer. I focus on essentially, I think part of the challenge is, being aware of the community you're in and mm-hmm. what barriers they may have to cancer care and to choosing radiation and, et cetera. I'm very fortunate that, the director of community engagement at our hospital, Chesley Cheatham, who's also mm-hmm. in my lab. Yeah. So, her insight has been very, valuable as far as, from a community standpoint and raising awareness, of this trial and of radiation, right? Because, most people outside of radiation oncologists have no idea what we do. And that includes
absolutely.
Doctors. Right. So if doctors have no idea what we do, like certainly most people have no idea. And, you hear all these, I can speak from the experience of somebody who was not a radiation oncologist, who was in neurosurgery. And I viewed radiation oncologists as like these little green men in the basement who like never went outside. Yeah. And I think that, if you kind of demystify that a bit, you can do a lot of good, but you have to be able to engage communities, talk with them. Mm-hmm. And again, this goes back to also building a team, right? So engaging the medical oncologists so that when patients come to their office, they can say, oh yes, there is this I'm recommending you for radiation oncology. There is this radiation, clinical trial, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer to your question is I am still trying to best address how do we do those things. And I feel like we're in a community that is diverse enough that we can answer those questions, but I'm still learning.
Yeah, and I think radiation oncology in general is not a diverse group of physicians in a way that adequately represents the patients that we care for. Mm-hmm. And I think there are always opportunities to improve that. In terms of, recruitment, retention, and engagement. And my very, of course, biased opinion is that ACRO has been a great place for that for me in a way that I feel like they have put people into leadership positions and have fostered the kind of community where a diverse set of persons and ideas and opportunities are available. So.
Yeah,
that's my plug.
Well, no, I would wholeheartedly second that. Jerry Jaboyne, he's been a big part of ACRO for many, many years. Perul Berry, obviously, mm-hmm. They're just studs, and
absolutely,
they've done so much for so many people, and ACRO has given them the platform to do that, I think that one of the good things about the whole, match apocalypse of 2019 in Radon is that it really has forced the many of the leaders of our field to have humility. Part of being humble is like saying, just because someone doesn't look like me or has my experience, like, well, I don't think they should be in Radon because they don't have blah, 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 blah. And I think, a lot of people are getting the opportunity that they wouldn't have gotten, prior to 2019, because of that. And I think ultimately that's a good thing for our field, because again, if we are really going to, we have to defend, what we do. A lot of people don't know what we do, and then there are people mm-hmm. who think it's what we do, but they don't. And then there are people who just think that we're, we're techs. They're like, I want this guy radiated. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Or they'll send a referral with a prescription for however many gray.
Right.
Or however many rads or rim. I've gotten all of the above in referrals before.
Right, exactly. You know, I just think, would you tell a surgeon what surgery to do?
Would you tell
a medical oncologist what chemotherapy to give?
It's
respect, right? Like, you know, we may strongly believe that someone needs surgery, but we're not surgeons, right?
We may strongly believe
that, hey, you know, we want carbotaxol as opposed to, you know, cisetoposide for this, right? But we're not medical oncologists, right? And they're not radiation oncologists. So again, I think part of advocacy for our field is expanding it, you know, to different voices. And, you know, and I think there's some people who are afraid of that because it's like, oh, if we have different voices, we'll sacrifice the quality of our field. And like, that's just, hasn't been shown through at all.
Why should diversity of thought be something that is to be feared?
You know? Well, I think for many, it's unknown, right? And we tend to fear the unknown. And I think that, but facing something like what happened in 2019 in our field forced many people to look into the unknown. And of course, literally the pandemic happening a year later, right? So it's like, I think, you know, those aspects, you know, for a trial like Sportsman, I think are not things that we shy away from. We actually embrace them
awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, this has been amazing. Like, I really enjoy like engaging conversation, kind of picking your brain on how you went through that design process and, you know, how you build support and really have just surrounded yourself with wonderful people in order to do so. Would it be okay if I kind of gave a recap of what some of, I think, the take home points have been, and then please interject.
Sure.
Get a good biostatistician on your team available and involved very early.
Yes.
Keep it simple and clear.
Yes.
Stay humble, but be motivated with your goal in mind.
Yes.
Be willing to know that it's going to take some time and several iterations to really get to the final product.
Mm-hmm.
And borrow the brilliance. Those are kind of my
picture
things.
Yep. And then the only one I would add is expect opposition. And, you know, and be ready to, you know, be anticipated, expect opposition happen. And you don't have to let it stop you.
I like it. That's awesome. It's fantastic. I look forward to seeing the results and some interim analysis as it goes along.
Thanks. And I do want to say that, you know, we are looking for other sites. So if there are additional sites who are interested in joining us in, you know, enrolling patients on our trial, you know, please do not hesitate to reach out to me. My email is, you know, is drwood@post.harvard.edu. That's drwood@post.harvard.edu. And, you know, again, we are looking for, you know, collaborators who, you know, essentially want to help us answer this question. I feel confident that we will be able to answer this question, but it'll be a lot easier and a lot faster. And again, more applicable if we're able to have several centers involved.
Yes, absolutely. Can I ask a clarifying question about that? Are there any parameters in terms of treatment planning or delivery for the 8x1 arm, or is it pretty open?
It's pretty open. Actually, the constraints we use for the SBRT are actually quite similar to RTOG 0915 for the 34 gray and 1 SBRT arm. You know, the cord dose, the brachial plexus dose, heart dose. The only difference is we're a little more strict on the small bowel DMAX. Mm-hmm. Ours is 11 gray and 0915 was like 12.2 gray. But we're actually a little more lenient for the esophagus. Ours is 16 gray and theirs, I think, was like 15.4 gray, something like that. But it's very similar. And again, like, we know that those constraints work. You know, we know 34 gray and 1 works and is safe. And actually, a lot of the constraints we use again, borrowing brilliance. You know, Dr. Spratt's, you know, team at Michigan used a lot of those constraints in, you know, their single fraction spine SBRT. And so, again, I think it's, you don't have to always reinvent the wheel, you know, like, you know, if you reinvent the wheel, like just like one out of every like 20 times, you're going to come up with something really new, right? Yes. You don't have to do it 10 out of 20 times or 15 or 18 out of 20 times.
No. Yeah. Having like a more like measured approach with achievable discrete outcomes, much more likely to be successful.
Amen.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, and I'd also like to give a shout out and plug your Twitter account and your research lab Twitter account.
So, thank you.
Yeah.
No, I appreciate that. I'm my Twitter account. I'm the Dr. Wood, THEDRWOOD. And my lab, our Twitter account is Dr. McClelland Lab. That's DrMCCLELLAND Lab. It's, again, we, you know, Twitter, I just joined Twitter like 2 years ago. And it's been a really remarkable resource being able to connect with other people and learn and share ideas. And again, like, I think it's going to be even more and more important from a social media standpoint, you know, for trials, because again, like waiting, you know, 3 and 4 years for a trial to come out, you know, not ideal, you know, and so it'll be good to kind of, you know, give updates on, you know, even, you know, trials like Sportsman and then the other, you know, the other programs I'm involved in for my lab, you know, as far as fostering, you know, optimal access to care. You know, the slogan of my lab is, you know, to tangibly foster equity and access to cancer killing radiation therapy, regardless of race, ethnicity, gender, or socioeconomic status. And so Sportsman definitely, you know, plays a role in that. And obviously we're not, you know, that goal is not limited.
That's awesome. Fantastic. It has been great chatting with you. I look forward to future podcasts with you.
That'd be great.
Thank you again for your time. It's been awesome.
You're welcome.